let's give this a shot. My name is Eric Lieber. I just got my MA, and I'm here to talk about failures of discourse, or what I call how Alberta talks about Olga. Okay, so I was providing an outline at the beginning of my talks, some caveats about public speaking. I'm going to explain what discourses are, and then I've got four case studies we can work our way through. All right, so I always try to get the crowd on my side by saying how hard this is and how nervous I am, and I'm going to try that again this time. So they've done some studies on public speaking, and most people would actually rather be in a casket than delivering a eulogy. And when you read behind the lines there, that means most people would rather be dead than public speaking. I've also seen cases on the internet where people have actually had heart attacks at the podium. I'm going to do my best not to do that. I'm 28, so I'm hoping. I also try to be funny, self-deprecating, some sarcasm. And sympathy laughs are more than welcome. I am a really awkward guy, so we'll do that. All right. I've got one slide on theory. I know it's not a popular topic. So, discourses. This is the way we talk about things. So there's really a million ways to say something, and the words you choose and the words you don't choose, there's meaning in that, right? So if I'm uncomfortable with him staring at me, you know, I can say, hey, buddy, stop staring at me, right? It's informal, it's a little bit assertive, you know. I can also say, please cease and desist, cease and desist, you know, it's invoking some legal language, yada, 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 right? I can just say, hey, will you do me a favor and please stop, you know, I'm trying to invoke some kind of friendship. So every time we do this, there's power and there's persuasion going on. And these have consequences, and that's what I want to talk about today. And we'll do this. So the first case study I looked at, I'm going to call a misunderstanding. And this is the debate over the sale of home oil in the early 1970s. And if I go too fast or I'm too quiet, just let me know. It's easier if you guys talk. So anyway, some context for the home oil case. It's the early 1970s. Peter Lougheed got elected first in 1965, got stronger in 1967, and he's just trying to be a pain in the ass for social credit. He's working. Now, two of the big things they've done while in opposition related to resources. They really went after social credit for the Benson White Paper on taxation. They said the social credit government wasn't doing enough to protect Alberta from federal taxes. They weren't doing enough to protect the industry. The Benson White Paper was going to bankrupt the province. Another thing they got a lot of points on was the Alberta Resources Railway. If you look at internal planning documents, they call this the $100 million white elephant. They say we can embarrass them, we can attack them on this and gain points. So that's just context. Okay, so in early January of 1971, the fact that home oil might be sold hits the newspapers. And they're talking about selling it to Ashland Oil of Kentucky, which is a big American oil company. Now, where this gets important is home oil was kind of special to Alberta. They thought it had a special place in the like provincial memory. It was the biggest independent in Calgary at the time, so this isn't Esso and Exxon and Imperial. And it was famous for being a wildcatter and a risk taker. So, Lougheed and Getty really want to score points off this. They see the potential sale of home oil and they're like, this is something we can use. And they want to play it up as uniquely Alberta. Now this gets a little bit interesting. Like, home oil was an Alberta company at the time, but if you look into its history, it was actually for a long time controlled by money in Vancouver. It wasn't an Alberta company. And even there was a good 20-year period where the majority of its shareholders lived in Quebec. So it's an Alberta company, but only recently and kind of tenuously. So then they sent out a news release on 9 February 1971. And then this is where I kind of like the language. So a BC government would be actively involved in keeping ownership control of the company in Alberta. Home oil has its roots sunk deeply in Alberta soil, right? And they're already trying to make connections about how important this company is to Alberta. And the majority of its assets are in fact held in our province. So this is where we get our first problem. So the Conservatives are campaigning as a free market thing. They're saying, we're going to do what social credit is doing, but better. So they're campaigning as a free market party. And there's a contradiction here, right? We want to stop the sale of home oil, but we can't do that as a free market party. One of their supporters writes in a letter saying, you guys, as a party dedicated to private enterprise, should abdicate the principles of private property and affirm the right of the owners to sell whoever they want. So we've got a contradiction here. Sorry, I think my slides got messed up in the conversion to...
I think Art Nixon was the next one.
Sorry, folks, this is always happens. So context, initial values, cultural... Sorry, folks.
we're interested in what you have to say.
Alright. Alright, I'll just go off this and we'll see how this goes. No promises. So anyways, the PCs want to be a free enterprise party, and this is going to be a problem when you're advocating against the sale of home water. So we've got this supporter writing to the PCs saying you guys aren't practicing what you're preaching by trying to stop this sale. And this is what Loughy wrote back, and this is kind of interesting because this is where it shows like kind of the awkward line they had to walk. So I'll just read here. I believe that there may be some confusion as to our position on this issue. Don Getty, in speaking about the sale of home oil shares, made it very clear that we do not advocate preventing the major owner, Mr. Brown, from selling to whomever he pleases. However, at the same time, we feel that effective steps could be taken to find Canadians who would be willing to put up the money. The Conservatives MLAs do feel that greater Albertan and Canadian participation in our own economy should be encouraged in every way possible, but we support a free enterprise. See, and this is just awkward language, right? You can tell he's trying to speak to two different crowds in this one sentence. And this is kind of where like our discourse gets corrupted. We're not actually talking about the sale of home oil anymore. We're talking about a threat to Alberta, we're talking about free enterprise, we're talking about what we can do and what we can't do. So when people start talking about this, Premier Harry Strong is in the unfortunate position of not being able to do anything because companies get bought and sold all the time. So he quoting him, is it fair for a government to tell me the owner of home oil, that although he had found a buyer for his firm, the sale cannot go ahead? And IPAC, the Independent Petroleum Association of Canada, I just took some excerpts from their words. They were extremely concerned this was a dangerous precedent. There were emotional concerns driving this. So, now what did Albertans say about this? A number of them wrote the government and the opposition saying, we would love to buy home oil and keep this Canadian and Albertan if a mechanism was available. Now this is troubling, because the home oil shares were for sale since 1920 on any number of stock exchanges. And the guy trying to sell it himself had actually got control of the company by buying shares. But this doesn't process for Albertans, right? We're not talking about the same thing. Some other interesting quotes I found. When a province is blessed with so much oil, aren't we entitled to own one company? There can never be a more golden opportunity to put into action what we have been giving a lot of lip service to, namely retaining control over our natural resources. Another one said, if so, we would never regain it for our children. And another quote I found is, we shouldn't have waited until 80% of our oil was American oil. Now, why is this trouble? It shows that we don't actually understand how the oil industry works. The majority of the oil in this province belongs to the Crown. We lease it, we have sales, we have royalties, we have development decisions, so we always control it. It's not about the nationality of the oil company. It's government decisions. And what makes this even more interesting, in the 1930s, this province went bonkers about that, right? Like, we asserted our ownership of the oil. There was no debate about it. Alberta owned this, right? We finally got it from the feds, we finally became a real province. So then why do we have debates? Like, why did we understand what was going on in the 1930s so well when it was a federal tension? But in the 1970s, when we're talking about oil companies being sold to Americans, we forget that we own the oil, right? Like, we asserted this. The other interesting thing is, at the same time, Banff Oil was going to be sold to Aquitaine Oils of France, and this didn't generate any debate. So it was just, oh, thank you for the laugh. Like, after the slide mess up, I was, oh man. All right, so I actually am on here. I'm starting to get back into here. So, that's the big deal with home oil. So, Loughy and Getty turned this into a metaphor, and they did it to win voter support. Now, when you do this, when you turn companies or events into metaphors, you emphasize something and you don't. You mask something else. Just like when you choose words, you're emphasizing something and not something else. I have some water here. Thanks for bearing with me.
I'm doing great.
Well, thank you. I am a nervous speaker, but I'm getting better. All right, so the second thing I looked at was the debate around the 1972 royalty review. So some background here. So in 1947, when they did the Leduc's discovery, the social credit government sees oil is the future. This is what's going to get us away from the boom and bust cycle of agricultural commodities. Well, thank you for the laughs, because it's ironic, right? Like, we're going to get away from boom and bust of agriculture, but now we're in the boom and bust of energy. But at the time, there was an oversupply of oil all over North America. So to kind of foster development, we give them low royalties, we give them easy access, we make the right of entry arbitration board to get them on land. And we're doing all these things to help that industry grow. So while in opposition, Peter Lougheed makes some statements about royalties. And it's essentially announced that they're too low. And the quote I found, it's like selling your house to pay for groceries. So they're on social credit for these low royalties. Lougheed himself also had ambitious plans to build over, like he had a province building agenda. So royalties were going to be a big part of that. And the other thing he did in opposition, when in opposition, was he promised to restore the legislature as the focal point of democracy in the province and avoid decision making by cabinet, which had kind of happened during the later Mannion years. So royalties are a touchy subject. Everyone in the province has a different opinion. Should they be high? Should they be low? I'm not going to get into that. But right before the election, I find Lougheed writing the consultant in Edmonton saying, what would happen if we just bumped up the royalty rates? The consultant writes back, you're going to reduce demand, you're going to be less competitive, you're going to encourage people to switch to different fuels, and you're going to anger the oil industry by breaking contracts and changing the rules in the middle of the game. Also, like Lougheed remembers the Benson controversy, right? Like, this province erupted when there was the potential of higher royalties. In February 1971, he has an interview with Hoyle. He doesn't say a thing about royalties. He knows this is important, but he knows this is a touchy topic, so he just doesn't talk about it. And all he states is that the party would maintain incentives to attract investment and protect the industry from federal intrusion. Now, other parties before the election, as we can guess.
Yeah.
So the NDP is saying this is the rightful heritage of the people of this province, not to preserve private interests. The Liberals say the market can stand an increase in oil royalties. Social credit, even, like, these are oil-friendly people, and they're saying there's an unlimited market for Alberta oil. And even the Edmonton Journal is saying what we could have justified 20 years ago as a royalty policy might not fly now. So in August and September, we have the election, and now we can kind of talk about royalties. So he goes back to oil, and he states that we won't make change for the sake of change. But then, later in the article, he says, changes were possible in surface rights compensation, pollution control, and the traditional 10-year revision of royalty rates. So this is interesting. Like, he does talk about royalties, but it's at the end of a sentence. And he also says traditional, right? Like, his hands are bound. It's not that I'm going to raise royalties to pay for my agenda. It's this is traditional, right? So the language he uses is kind of, he's positioning himself to be able to pull this off. So, this is where we get back also to his original quote about the legislature is the center of the decision-making in the province. So he had campaigned on that. He made a big deal about social credit being kind of anti-democratic. Now he gets elected and things are different, right? So he tells the Edmonton Journal that the public will have the opportunity to comment on new oil and gas agreements, but he wasn't sure the government was going to do public hearings. And he also, and this is kind of interesting, he reminded the public that they could do it all through cabinet, and he didn't need to go through the legislature. So this is already a big change from when he was trying to get points in opposition by saying social credit was anti-democratic. So we've got to push for a public debate. The Conservatives have promised this. The Liberals and the NDP, and even public sentiment, kind of said, look, we should talk about royalties. This is important to the province. Newspapers all over the province were saying, have this open debate, let's all talk about it. And even the Edmonton Journal said, the public at large can't help but gain a better understanding of the delicate balance between maximum returns from the province's natural resources and the phenomenon commonly described as killing the goose that lays the golden egg. So, we know the OLT issue is coming, and the Conservatives are getting ready. The Secretary to the Premier starts writing letters because he knows correspondence is going to be coming in. He's got one letter for people who want lower royalties, one for people who want status quo, and one letter for people who want higher royalties. So, this is the Secretary's letter, and it went to Bill Dickey, the Minister of Energy, who edited it. So it's interesting, the first draft said, "The final decision on this matter will be made by the Alberta legislature after public hearings and a full review." Dickie just crosses that out and writes cabinet, right? Like, when I saw this memo, I thought, holy cow, this is politicking at its best, right? Now, this letter also says, "Public hearings will not be able to hear representation from individuals because we feel strongly that MLAs are elected to represent their constituents." Now, just like 3 days before that, in the legislature, they actually had a debate about the ability of MLAs to represent the diverse interests in their constituencies. And this is in the Hansard. So Gordon Taylor was a social credit MLA who had been around for decades. And he says, "When the Honourable Premier suggests that the MLA can represent the individuals, I would say this is really impossible. I can't represent the thinking of every individual in my constituency. Neither can he. Neither can any honourable member of this legislature. Because there may be 10 or 15 very divergent points of view." So again, you see, we'll promise you democracy when we're in your opposition and say how much better it would be. But as soon as we get the power, we have to back away. So how did the review play out? They only heard from associations or groups, which actually turned out to be about 22 oil companies and the U of A Students Union, who actually supported lower royalties. They were against any raise, which I'm still trying to figure out. And in that debate, MLAs were only allowed one question each, and I found memos saying they were really frustrated. They thought the oil companies didn't answer their questions, tried to misdirect them. And it only lasted 3 days. So in the first session of the legislature, royalties, like the future economic health of this province, actually got less attention than automobile insurance and provincial parks, which is incredible. So what do we learn from this, right? It's easier to make promises in opposition than it is to actually deliver on them. And, again, just like the home oil debate was never really a debate, it was just about, you know, finding your stance, getting people worked up. We never really did talk about royalties. Another failure of discourse I came across had to do with the government support for the Syncrude project. Now, some background on oil sands. This is a tough resource to develop, as we all know. For up to a century, people had tried. Nobody could really get this to happen economically. Great Canadian oil sands, now Suncor, pulled it off. This is a big deal. Early 60s, we got a working oil sands plant. The other problem we ran into with the oil sands is Alberta already had too much oil from its conventional oil fields, and all our exports were prorated, like we only had a limited amount sent over the province. So if suddenly we get a million barrels from the oil sands, that million barrels has to give in somewhere else. And the province knew this, so they really kind of gave oil sands companies a runaround. They would approve something and make public statements in support of it, and then a month later they would back off and say maybe it's not the time. And oil companies are pulling out their hair because they don't know if they've got government support for their plant. Now, Syncrude, I think, filed the original application in 1962 as the four companies. And they've gone through the process now for 7 years of getting support, not getting support, thinking that the government's going to be behind them, thinking the government is. So how did they respond? They want to move this forward, they want to get support. So they say the project might not go forward. So they frame it as fragile, right? The language they use to describe it is, this might not go, it might cancel, it might fall through, and there's a possibility that the project will fail. So the first crisis in 1969, they're waiting for Oil and Gas Conservation Board, or EUB, or ERC, or whatever we call it now. They send out this press release. So they say, unless we get early approval for our, and they make sure to emphasize how much money they're spending, as they do now, $300 million oil sands plant, the project, the plant, and the company could be scrapped. Any additional delay may as well have the same effect as denial. So already, there's a crisis. If we do not do something about this, if the government does not step forward, there's going to be a problem. So, now we've got the theorists, right? There's a chance that we might not develop the oil sands. So in the legislature, while the progressive conservatives are still in opposition, Don Getty just stands up out of nowhere and demands an assurance from the government that Great Canadian Oil Sands is not on the verge of a shutdown. And the government just goes, what are you talking about? And so Getty said his information was based on rumors and that he couldn't actually evaluate the precise credibility of those rumors. But he thought when he was going forward, this was going to look good, right? Like, if we can use this fear, if we can get people scared, I can gain points. And this is just becoming part of the way we talk about the oil sands in the legislature. Okay, so in August 1971, The Syncrude Consortium, they haven't built anything yet, but they submit a proposal to go from 80,000 barrels a day to 125. The company argues the move will address the foreseeable energy gap facing the country. So there's kind of hints of tension in the Middle East, but there's really no energy gap facing Canada at the time. But again, this is a useful thing to invoke when we're trying to pressure the government. A lot of, he's still in opposition, says the Socred stalling on this approval is actually hurting the country, which is, again, is a big statement to make, but, you know, this is politics, right? We use language in a certain way. Now, this is where it gets interesting. So Premier Strong comes out and says that company will receive its approval, and this is before the Oil and Gas Conservation Board even had a chance to debate it, right? So here we go, like, politicking trumps the independence of that regulator, right? Like, if you look at the history of the Oil and Gas Conservation Board, it is well respected. Like, when you, comparing it to things in Oklahoma and Texas, we had done a really good job, and we're just throwing out that because we have to, you know, worry about political posturing. So, again, we're going forward. Syncrude wants this to go. They want government support, so now we're going to come up with a substitution risk. It's not a foreseeable energy gap. It's not about the plant not getting built. It's now the Colorado oil shales are going to trump us, and you guys in the government have to get off your butts and support this, or else we're going to lose. So, F.K. Spraggins, the president of Syncrude, writes a letter to the Minister of Energy, Bill Dickey. And this is before they had even raised royalty rates. This was just talking about the possibility of raising the royalty rates. And he says these would be in direct contrast to the incentives being considered for shale and would only place Alberta's tar sands at a distinct disadvantage. Even the Edmonton Chamber of Commerce is saying, holy cow, we can't lose this, right? We've got time slots with forging industries that if we don't support this as a province, it's not going to happen. And another crisis. So in the 1970s, the Middle East crisis reduced imports supply concerns. So Syncrude comes out and speaks publicly about the wartime situation and how their plant can avert a fuel crisis in the coming months. Now this isn't true, right? You can't build an oil sands plant in months. But this is convenient language to evoke, right? Like we're trying to gain the debate, so it looks like you guys should help us. And that's what really matters. Sorry, I'm getting... Okay, so what Syncrude illustrated to me is the power of crisis and provincial resource politics. They can be used, right? Like we saw Don Getty use them and we saw Syncrude use them. And it doesn't really matter what crisis. It could be a supply, it could be lost time with forging industries, it could be whatever, but you have a crisis and you can use it. And what this did is, again, leads to a failure of discourse, right? We never really did sit down clearly and talk about what's the role of the Alberta provincial government in supporting oil sands plants. All right, so the last thing I want to talk about is sour gas in the province leading up to the Lodge Pole blower. So, kind of some background on the sour gas. 1970s, we're booming, right? Alberta's doing great. People are moving here, cities are getting bigger. And there's a big, like, the Department of Municipal Affairs doubled in this time because we've got all this new land, all these new subdivisions, all these new towns, municipalities, cities. The problem is, all of Alberta's sour gas fields are between Edmonton and Calgary, right in the middle, where everyone's living, right? So now we've got more demands for land and more demands for gas. And then the province is stuck. How do we manage the trade-off between public safety and resource development? And the answer is, we do it poorly. So between the 1960s and the late 1970s, government policy on sour gas alienated everyone. It could make no one happy. So municipalities, industry, everybody angry. One of the first moves to deal with the sour gas issue came in 1968, and they called it the Government and Industry Sour Gas Committee meeting. This is notes from their first meeting, and they're essentially saying, we don't know what to do. Like, no one on this committee has any suggestions about what any policies or programs or procedures to do around sour gas, so we'll just meet later, I guess. Thank you. I'm just trying to laugh. See, and you've been kind of, it's nice to see the smile from you too. Okay. Alright, so in 1973 we do have a problem with sour gas. In Norway there's a release from a pipeline. And this is actually kind of funny. Papers picked it up as people were dying in the streets from toxic gas clouds flying around. It didn't really happen that way. There was a little release, a few people went to the hospital, but it wasn't a big deal. Now in the legislature, Dr. Neuwirner says, very toxic nature of H2S, and this is all stuff generated by the new Norway release, but, you know, emphasizing very toxic, not just toxic, very toxic. So the government starts to regulate plants, and then these companies say, well, no, that's not fair, this is extra operating cost, we can't be profitable if you do this. And the government and regulators just dance, plant by plant, regulation by regulation. And it's obvious the government's still trying to figure out how to manage that gas. So the pressure jack builds. This is, working for a government, I get this now. We form another committee, and it's the Alberta Industry Government Sour Gas Environmental Committee on Guidelines for Urban Development in relation to the, when you say sour gas twice in your committee title, you know you're just searching for words. But again, like, it sounds formal and the government's doing something, right? And all these people come up with is there is a need for an examination, right? So whereas the first people said we don't know what to do, these people say, well, at the very least we should start thinking about this. And the government's stuck in a hard spot here, right? Because developing sour gas, this is revenue, this is jobs, this is expansion, this is the economy, this makes people happy. But if a sour gas field blows up under a subdivision, people are going to be mad. So they also need to assure public safety. And they also need to let these municipalities, who are growing by thousands of people a year, to expand. They need the land. And the end result of all this tension is nothing. I'm working for a government now, I get that. So the municipalities are really getting angry with the situation. Some correspondence I found from the Battle River Planning Commission, they stated they were confused on what legal stand they could take when a company asked to drill a sour well by a community. They also reminded the government in the same letter that it was in the greater public concern not to create confusion. So you can tell that this municipality is really angry. And I guess they had met privately with some representatives, but they said the comments made in private meetings with government officials sounded totally different in political reality. So this is a situation where they assured municipal owners that yes, we can do this, but as soon as a politician gets up and speaks, it's all out the window, right? And this is where we just get bogged down in language and we can't actually talk about it. Other people in this debate just get confused. The Calico Petroleum writes the government, are we correct in assuming that there is no law or clear policy governing the matter? Like, very rarely do you get companies asking the government to regulate, give us, you know, give us rules. But this is how bad sour gas got up until the blow. And the ERCB is making contradictory decisions across the province. So in Calamar, they won't approve this, but they'll approve this in Devon and Drake Valley. And they've actually got even MLAs from the government to ask beyond their own ministers to check into the rather strange actions of the board. Okay, so finally in the late 70s, the provincial government just comes clean. The planning board writes a letter. No one has even attempted to define this problem. And the province lacked any guidelines which would have universal application as a general guide for the benefit of all concerned. Even the ERCB, the people that are supposed to be on top of this, say there's no obvious solution to this problem. Excuse me. So, the inability to talk about sour gas, we're getting so bogged down in who should be doing what in these tensions. Throughout the 1970s, there's no clear rules, and it just keeps going and going. There's dances, but nothing's really happening. The 1973 New Norway release, and the 77 blowout in Lodgepole it wasn't enough to prompt something. So it took the 82 Lodgepole blowout, which went for more than 60 days and had two people die in it, to actually get the province starting to talk about sour gas. And so, awkwardly, that's how I end. I feel bad because I kind of rushed through things really when my slides weren't working, but just, there's a tendency not to talk about things in this province, right? Like, we've got these discourses that have their own inherent values, and they never talk to each other. They talk past each other, they talk through each other, right? Like, a contemporary example is the debate about oil sands, and greenhouse gas emissions, right? So there's kind of a discourse that I call strategic, right? And it's like, we've got this much reserves, we can do this, this pipeline goes here. And then there's like an environmental discourse, right? Like, these carbon emissions are going to drown us, we, you know, can't. And nobody's talking to each other, we're just talking through each other. And that stops us from like really addressing problems. And I guess that's the point I was trying to bring up in this presentation. So, that was it.